Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Here is a commissioning editor whose hair is entirely above reproach.
I had never considered that when you were comparing my hair to that of a poodle, it was a reproach necessarily. No. So I've added that.
Well, I haven't actually said your name. Thea, let it do. Say hello. ALF update?
I have nothing to report, which is good news.
He's settling again.
He's settling, yeah, he's settling.
Okay.
It's going to go on for a long time, I think. For Christmas, This is how far in advance we're working here. For Christmas.
You're planning Christmas
we
already?
We have to bring him to London because he can't stay by himself. And that's where my family will be for various complicated reasons. And the idea of bringing Alf to London is just completely...
It's May, though.
I know, Okay.
So there's plenty of updates to come. We should get him in the paper.
We should get him on the podcast.
Yeah.
He has an excellent yawn. It's very high-pitched.
Well, next time you're off, in inverted commas, working from home, we'll give you a call. Do you want to subscribe to the TLS? Of course you do. Here is how you can do it. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. That's podcast.the-tls.com. And if you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. And you get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. Coming up on today's show, Queen Victoria was born 200 years ago, almost to the day. I know, hasn't time flown? The first half of the TLS this week is devoted to Victoria and Victoriana, and our cartoonist Ella Barron has drawn a lovely picture for the cover. History editor David Horsepool is not, I repeat, not an eminent Victorian, but he's going to do his best and talk us through what we need to know about this anniversary. The TLS is also going to be handed out at Hay Festival next week, and to celebrate, we've gathered together a collection of Hay contributors and asked them this simple question. What books inspired you as a youngster? So we thought we'd gather together some TLS folk and ask them the same question too. Queen Victoria still reigns over our historical imagination. Like the first Elizabeth, she's easily rendered in our minds as an oversimplified image. Squat and jowly, clad in interminable black, she scowls straight back at us. And the age she has come to embody, even more so than the Elizabethan, is still resonant today. We know what people mean by Victorian values. We're starting to publicly acknowledge the cost of Victorian imperialism. When Jacob Rees-Mogg, something of a caricature of an MP and public intellectual, recently wished to hark back to a certain sensibility to stiffen the sinews of the nation, he published a book called The Victorians, 12 Titans Who Forged Britain. We're not reviewing it in the TLS, but we are looking at lots of books, generally better written and researched, that are about the period. For, as Clarissa Campbell Orr notes this week, 2 centuries after her birth, there are still new things to say about Queen Victoria and her royal legacy. She nominates as a masterpiece Miles Taylor's Empress, which seeks to shift the narrative of a woman who was as much a Maharani as a British monarch. It's striking that three of the longest-lasting, most iconic and arguably successful monarchs in British history have all been women. But what if Victoria had been born a boy? Such a lad would have been the King of Hanover and so changed Anglo-German relations in the run-up to the First World War for good. To explain this and other thoughts contained in the paper is the TLS's very own populist who, like Jacob Rees-Mogg, is not specifically an expert in the Victorian period. David Horsfall.
That's very correct. Hello, Stig. Hello, Thea.
Why, not for you, obviously, but why does the Victorian period resonate these days, David, do you think?
Well, I think there's a bit more to it than the fact, the simple fact that it's 200 years since the birth of Victoria and indeed of Albert, which always helps people focus their minds. Yeah. The length of the reign is one of them, that it spans the century. And the amazing transformations that happened during that reign. I think if you think at the beginning of Victoria's reign in 1837, it probably would have taken about 2 days to get from London to Bristol. And by the end of her reign, it would take about the same time as it does now, or possibly a little bit shorter, something like 3 hours. And by the time of her Diamond Jubilee in 1897, she was able to communicate with the whole of her empire, which famously spanned the globe by telegraph. So that's an amazing transformation that happened over this
period. So the birth of modernity.
Period. Absolutely. It was the time of the birth of modernity, but we also look back to it, I think, as a sort of conflicted time of British greatness. But, you know, was there a dark underbelly to that British greatness? So there's always an interesting debate to talk about.
And possibly now, as we debate what Britishness is, perhaps more than ever, although I suspect we've often done it, but perhaps more than ever, that sense of when Britain was really being forged as a global power becomes more pressing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there much new to say? Clarissa Campbell-Orr says that there is. Do you feel, I mean, one of your problems as history editor is an awful lot of the subjects you cover have been covered for almost since they stopped happening.
Absolutely. And so
I'm thinking the Second World War is another good example, isn't it?
And is there something new to say? Of course there is, but all historians always say that about everything because otherwise they'd be out of a job. I think in the case of the Victorians and the Victorian era, there's bound to be new stuff to say. There's new ways of looking at that period in history and all the many millions of people who lived through it. In terms of the Queen herself, it also turns out that there are new things to say. If you think that the kind of personal side of the monarch has been quite well poured over and looked at, there's a online you can now look at 141 volumes of the Queen's own diaries. So you have a real insight into her private life, but only a kind of edited one, because I think her daughter took out anything racy
about
or
she had
controversial
sex with the servants, that sort of thing.
Exactly, who knows.
Do people not know that?
No, I think people don't know. Yeah. They speculate and they, you know, write books and have films about her various relations sort of post Albert, but nobody knows. So the personal side of things can get rather trodden over. But looking at Victoria as a monarch, I think as this Clarissa Campbell-Orr piece shows, and particularly in her focus on the Miles Taylor book about her as Empress of India, shows that there really is a new way of looking at her.
I'd certainly never really thought about her as this master of soft power, which really comes out in this.
Yeah, I think that does. And as Clarissa has in her piece, she contrasts it with the kind of classic view of the monarchy, is it of a shrinking power being more and more trammelled by Parliament and then by democracy and so on. And of course that was going on during the 19th century and had already gone on before Queen Victoria came to the throne. But at the same time, there was this sort of expansion of soft power, and particularly in India, if you think that about 20 years into her reign, the Indian Mutiny happened, what the Indian call the First War of Indian Independence happened, and the reaction on the British side to that was to take power away from the East India Company under Crown rule. And that was more than the Crown just standing in for British government. It also meant a sort of personal pact between the various royals. There are 500 princely states that Campbell-Orr writes about in India, to whom a direct appeal was made as monarch to monarch. And so this idea that there was a royal power in India makes quite a lot of sense to me.
And actually, as with the concept of empire through the Roman Empire, emperors were rather regarded as human beings and fallible in Rome. But as you went further away, they were deified, they were seen as greater than they were in their home, which is possibly true of the British Empire as well, the sort of the iconography of the Queen, who in the 1860s was basically so unpopular there was a crisis, wasn't there?
Well, at home she was very unpopular, and of course she never visited India, so that might have added to the
mystique. Isn't that strange?
Well, it would have been a huge thing for her to have gone that far. I mean, she wasn't a great traveller, I don't think, the Queen, and she famously asked for her train from Slough to London to be slowed down because at 40 miles an hour it was making her feel sick. And I've sat in a royal, I think it is Queen Victoria's royal carriage, you can go and sit in it in the York Railway Museum, and it's very nice, well-appointed kind of Victorian saloon. So if that was too uncomfortable for her, the idea of a steamer across.
But the icon was therefore more important than the person.
Yes, I think so. And her son did go out to India. Her third son, Duke of Connaught, was out in India. So there was that direct royal connection. And Campbell calls it a kind of gestalt switch, this way of looking at Victoria, rather than this monarch having to submit to the politicians, finding ways to expand her influence without it being a sort of direct lawmaking fashion.
Well, let's talk of gestalt switches. Right. If we may. Jane Ridley has written a counterfactual account, which came up originally. This idea came up in one of our meetings, and Rupert's Short, the religion editor, I think, mentioned this. Because if Victoria was going to be called, if Victoria was going to be a boy, she probably would have been called Alexander. So the question is, what would King Alexander have looked like and done? And the challenge was set for Jane Ridley to write about the putative life of King Alexander, the person Victoria would have been had she been a boy.
And Jane Ridley is very well qualified to do so. She's the biographer, a biographer of Queen Victoria. She imagines King Alexander as looking bulgy-eyed and mentions if Victoria had been a man, if King Alexander had filled her tiny shoes. So we have a kind of physical picture of possibly something of a kind of martinet. But the sort of political picture that Jane Ridley gives is fascinating. There are interesting insights into what would have happened in Hanover, because Hanover was the dual monarchy, but Queen Victoria couldn't be the monarch of it because of their own Hanoverian laws, which forbade a woman to be the monarch, but King Alexander could have been the monarch, so it would have been a dual monarchy. And she speculates that that would have been more of a challenge for Bismarck to dismiss when it came to unifying Germany. So there would have been a likely confrontation with Germany. And rather paradoxically, she also thinks that the court itself back in Britain would have been less German. There wouldn't necessarily have been an Albert figure as a consort. We know that Queen Victoria and her husband spoke German at home. And that probably wouldn't have happened. But most fascinatingly, I think, in her speculations are about the ways that Queen Victoria was able to keep power within the monarchy in a way that a more direct would-be absolute monarch of the kind of the sort of German model just wouldn't have been able to do.
She says that Victoria's gender saved the monarchy.
Yes, yeah, and I think I understand that in a kind of paradoxical way, that you would have thought that a stronger monarch would have done more to save the monarchy, but in fact, in a way, he wouldn't have done, because his challenge would have had to have been reacted to by the real power in the land, which was in Parliament and the parliamentary government.
It might have been a republic by now.
Well, it's possible, depending on how the reaction would have played out. I mean, it's always difficult with these speculations to wonder how far to go. But absolutely, it's possible. So, you know, in the long run, we might, as sort of modern Britons, look back and think, well, might have been a missed opportunity, the kind of shoring up of the monarchy, and also this reselling, repackaging of the monarchy, which is very much Albert's work, as a kind of bourgeois family, as she puts it, as a sort of premier family to aspire to emulate in the country with their Christmas trees and their all gathered around the fire kind of idea. If it had been a much more court-based, austere, or grand looking thing, that would have been very much more distant from the British public.
It is striking that the three biggest monarchs, or the three most long-lasting, I presume, the three almost most notable in iconic terms in Britain are all women.
Yeah.
And they have shaped to a large extent.
I think Elizabeth I isn't that long-lasting compared to, I don't know, Henry III or something. Yeah. But certainly, yeah, they're much more important as monarchs than almost any other person who sat on the throne, which is an extraordinary thing because for a very long time in British history, it was impossible to be a ruling woman, really, as an example of Matilda showed in the Middle Ages.
Talk about men and women. The Ely Williams has given us a piece of writing on the Rebecca riots. Thea,
did
you know about this?
No, I didn't know about the Rebecca riots until this piece.
Me neither.
Was proposed, and it's just so interesting. I had no idea. Tell us.
Well,
you know about it, didn't you?
I know a little bit about it.
Because you wrote a book on
I wrote a book called The English Rebel, and this is Welsh Rebellion. I did include it partly because Wales in the late 1830s and the 1840s was a kind of hotbed of rebellion, which went across the border as well. The Rebecca riots are part of a kind of rural rebellion similar to the Captain Swing riots around the same time, which were against threshing machines. In Wales, the Rebecca riots were attacking the toll gates and turnpikes, and they were called Rebecca based on a verse in Genesis to do with Rebecca, and it says in the short story, Rebecca's, let thy seed possess the gate of those which hate them. They attack these gates dressed as women, and that comes out in this.
Why are they dressed as women?
I think as a way of disguising themselves and also to completely disconcert people who had to deal with them. They didn't really know what they were being attacked by. And it was quite a serious outbreak of violence and protest, and it had some effect. Some of the people who were involved in it were transported, but it did have some effect. The turnpikes themselves weren't pulled down, but the tolls were recast and stuff like that, so it did have a kind of positive effect. Whereas at the same time, one of the largest risings in British history happened in 1840 in Newport, the Newport Rising. 10,000 people rose, 22, and there was a Chartist rising. 22 of them were shot dead, and they attacked a group of soldiers as well. And the ringleaders were caught, tried, and they were sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered in 1840.
God.
That didn't happen, possibly because 1840, I think, was also the year that Victoria and Albert got married, and it wasn't thought that this would be a very good
look. Wasn't really on theme.
So they ended up being transported as well.
Why is that not known more? Because that's more desperate
than Peterloo.
I don't know,
more people should read The English Rebel, really.
Really? It sounds like a great book, but that's more death than Peterloo, isn't it?
Yes, it is more death than Peterloo.
Peterloo, it shows a branding.
Which is of course, we're in an anniversary of Peterloo, of course.
We are, but branded after Waterloo, and therefore immediately, and there's probably something in there, isn't it? That name has rung out through history because of
the sort of branding, whereas the Newport Rising is rather forgotten, but was a bigger, and it was a kind of revolutionary threat, it was thought at the time.
You'd have to call it New Loo.
We'd have to be called New Loo, which doesn't sound good.
They probably thought about us, but people probably obviously thought about this. It's not worked at all. Before we go, David, anything else? There's a lot of Victorian stuff. We've got Ruskin, Clough, Whitman. Victoria didn't say we're not amused.
She didn't say we're not amused, apparently.
And Victorians were often amused.
They were often amused. They went to marionette theatres. They went to music halls.
People were suspended from the sky on bulls. They had a great time.
And, of course, they went to football matches. There was a lot of, Victorian time is also the rise of the modern sporting
Leisure craze. Activity generally, I suppose.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So anything else?
There's Arthur Hugh Clough, I think we did talk about as well. I noticed he's a peculiarly modern.
I'll
give you a fact about Arthur Yukoff, also born in 1819, the poet.
So is George Eliot, by the way, and Herman Melville.
Well, everybody was born in 1819. Who was anybody?
Yeah.
But he said, in this very exciting precursor of our modern concerns, "For meat and drink and all things, there is one sole machine, not made with hands, not capable of duplication, this terraqueous globe that moves incommunicably tied to one unchanging orbit." So he was an early environmentalist, and we should listen to Arthur Hugh Clough.
We've got to protect our terraqueous globe.
Absolutely.
That's a good campaign slogan, isn't it?
Yeah. Greta, I hope you're listening.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This week, to coincide with the start of the Hay Literary Festival in Wales, we asked a selection of writers and thinkers to tell us about the books that struck them as young readers, and which, in one way or another, have stayed with them ever since. The result is a series of snapshots from the reading lives of contributors including Steven Pinker, Bernardine Evaristo, Catherine Rundell, and Jared Diamond. We've given it the title Before the Tree to acknowledge how a book can, seed-like, find fertile ground in the mind of a young reader. This goes for people of any age, of course, but the right book, at the right time, can reveal something new about the same old world. Better still, it might inspire that reader to write something themselves. Michael Rosen, remembering the effects of first reading the American poet Carl Sandburg, writes about wanting to grab the world around me with the same energy and accessibility, and I wanted to match his egalitarian belief in the power of ordinary people's interactions. And speaking of ordinary people's interactions, we are joined now in the studio.
Nicely done, dear.
By a gaggle. I don't know, did we ever come up with a collective noun for a group of editors?
TLS editors.
A flother?
Ordinary editors.
Yeah.
A mob, like kangaroos? Come on, guys.
A disgruntlement.
A disgruntlement of TLS editors.
Yeah. We're speechless.
Anyway, we're joined by a bunch of TLS editors to discuss all of this, as well as telling us about the books that they most fondly remember. So joining Sig, David and me are fiction and politics editor Toby Lichtig. Cue gags about how the two roles conflate.
Oh yes, every time.
Our feature editor, Roz Deneen, who's shocked and not speaking to me now. And our arts editor, Lucy Dallas.
Hello, also shocked.
Also shocked.
Can we also just do it before you enter this? You actually arrived early for the recording of this while we were talking to David about Victoriana.
You did.
Matt, the producer, set you... This did happen. I've not just taken some drugs and just...
No, what are you talking about, Stig? I really
this
don't
happened,
know what...
Yeah.
No,
and it was happen. Successful.
He set you a challenge.
He said, go and find me... like we were children.
Yes.
He said, go and find me a metre-long stick... an elastic band, some gaffer tape, and the word colour in newsprint.
And we responded just like we were children.
We okay, ran yeah. off.
I'd have told him to sod off.
And we did it.
He sounds like a weird fetishist as well. A gaffer tape and a meter stick. Hang on.
But you did it. Do you know what? I take it back. You are all extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly. That is extraordinary.
I just found a meter long stick.
Yeah. You did it.
And you've got to hear this gaffer tape in the studio.
It says
like
Achtung on
Seven.
It.
It's really not like a scene from Seven, can I say?
It's
dear
like
listener,
it's like
not
a literary
like a
version of Seven.
Okay, so welcome, one and all. Let's start by picking our way through this symposium, shall we? Do any of these chime with you, delight you, surprise you?
I was very delighted to see Kamal Ahmed's contribution, which is Bernard Ashley's book, The Trouble with Donovan Croft, because it's something that I simply hadn't thought about since I last read it when I was probably about 9 or 10.
I've never heard of it.
It was just a book that I realised I had and read 3 or 4 times. I absolutely loved it. Have never come across it or thought about it in any way since, and read his contribution, just got this wonderful jolt of memory, as we do when we look back to our childhood reading, especially if we haven't thought about it for a long time. So it's a story of this young black boy who gets fostered by a white family and he's traumatised and he goes mute. He doesn't talk at all for, as far as I remember, pretty much all of the book. And he's got this brother who has to sort of be his guardian at school. And it's in the 70s, it's very racist. His brother's getting a lot of difficulty from other pupils. And it was incredibly affecting, I remember. And it was sort of, it described, you know, I did not grow up in this world at all. I grew up in a very, very white world without foster parents and, you know, just in a very untroubled family. And there was something so other about it and so empathetic about the way it was written. And I remember reading the book over and over again. And then, as I say, I haven't thought about it for many
decades.
And
interesting, probably as a kid, you don't always think in terms of race or in terms of the experiences of others, because that's what childhood isn't really about.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's amazing that a book can do that.
It really showed showed me another world. And yet, you know, he was a kid my age and it was easy to, you know, he was interested in kid things. He was very into football, I seem to remember, as was I and as was everyone else.
Trouble with Donovan Croft.
Trouble with Donovan Croft, and yes, so Donovan Croft is the boy, and he's deemed sort of sullen and difficult by his teachers and weird by the kids. But he has this rich and angry inner life, which, as far as I remember, comes out very well towards the end.
Yeah, amazing. Who else?
Catherine Rundell said she loved What Katie Did, and I had forgotten. I was thinking about childhood books, obviously, for this, and I remembered What Katie Did, and it's brilliant.
1872?
I guess. I mean, I couldn't have... Yeah.
I remember my sister reading all of those, but I never did. What?
It's that American thing, and it kind of... I think it led me on. I can't remember if it's that way around. I conflate it in my mind with Little Women.
I was gonna say,
with those sorts of stories. There's quite a rambunctious family, and Katie is quite naughty and sort of tomboyish, and she's playing on a swing. That's how naughty she is.
Oh my God. Shouldn't be allowed that.
And there's something wrong with the swing, and they've told her not to do it before. I mean, this is really, you know, trying to remember it. And she's cross, and she does it anyway, and she plays on the swing, and then she has an awful accident and basically can't move. And he's in it. No, it's all right. Stig's making a face at me. It gets happier.
Is it for girls, traditionally?
I think it was probably aimed at girls.
I'm not saying that. Don't look at me. Now Roz is looking at me. But no, because I think, actually, growing up, any time other than now, books were really
split. In 1872.
In 1872, so were. Little Women was aimed at female audience, for example. But I grew up, there were books that were for girls, and they probably still are now. I mean, everyone ignores it, but they were... Books were split much more that way, wasn't
probably.
It?
I don't suppose my brother ever read it,
no.
And I absolutely devoured it.
And did you read it because it was a strong female character?
No, I read it. I mean, read it the same way you read anything, because it was there. You just read whatever is in front of you, and I loved it. And she kind of, you know, grew to love people and understand herself. And it's, I think it's very pretty strongly Christian now I think about it, the same as Little Women. Yeah, but I didn't mind that at all.
Well, you quite often don't pick that up at all. I mean, C.S.
Lewis.
I didn't
get that.
No, but I did mind, actually. Narnia, I did mind because it wasn't obvious. It wasn't straight out.
Could you tell, though?
No, and then someone told me, and I went, what?
Aslan's Jesus, what? No!
Whereas this was just straightforward.
Have you ever read The Screwtape Letters? Anyone else read that by C.S. Lewis?
No. So they used to play it in the lift.
It's really good. And basically what it is, it's a letter written by a demon to another demon, and it's basically hell is like a civil service bureaucracy, and the Screwtape Letters are from one demon training up a younger demon in the bureaucracy of deviling, and it's really fun. And have you read it?
I've read a bit of it.
Oh no, have I misremembered it?
No, I think it is quite fun.
Oh,
it's not as fun as like Molesworth and stuff.
I read Molesworth after you recommended it, and
don't tell me you didn't like Molesworth.
I think you have to be 11, don't you?
I just thought it was a bit obvious. Molesworth is... Do you know who Molesworth...
Of course.
Yeah. Does everyone here know Molesworth?
No.
Love Molesworth.
So what is it? How do you explain it?
Well, he was the terror of 2B. And he...
It's a school kind of
thing. The whole thing is... it's Ronald Searle, isn't it? The whole thing's written in misspelled schoolboy prose.
Any fool know in Private Eye is Molesworthianism.
Yeah.
He's at St Custard's.
He's at St Custard's. And there's just a lot of very, very cruel teachers and boys sort of kicking each other in the shorts and stuff. It's very funny.
Bad Latin. It's really funny.
Yeah. I bought it because Lucy recommended it.
My elder son had a copy of it, and I found it recently, and he'd gone through it aged 8, correcting all the spelling.
Oh, that's magnificent. That would take a long time because
really did.
Yeah. That is come and work so here. Beautiful.
Yeah, it really should.
There's a sub editor in him, isn't there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Poor thing.
Was that one of your choices then, David, that book?
No, it hadn't occurred to me.
We're still doing other people's choices.
I was very taken by Marcus de Sotoy's choice, which would never have occurred to me in a million years.
Oh, for God's sake, yeah.
he chose A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy, a 1940 book about being a mathematician, which to me sounds extraordinary that you'd want to read that. But I think... You know, Marcus de Sotoy emerged from it the man he is, a leading mathematician.
Well, this is rather inspiring. It was like a magical story that took you on a journey through infinity. This sparked my love of mathematics, ultimately inspired me to create my own mathematical proofs to take me to infinity and beyond.
Pretty good. Unlock the secret garden of mathematics. Who knew?
People who are really good at maths are a different species.
Well, absolutely.
He gives his teacher a shout out, which is, I think, quite lovely. Mr. Baleson.
Yeah. I was quite fond of A.C. Grayling mentioning the faraway tree. I foist that on my children, and they've both read it in a way that Enid Blyton, you're always a bit reluctant to foist because it's so backward. And Famous Five is particularly backward, I think. It's, you know, the girl.
It's not very well written, I don't think, Enid Blyton as well.
But The Faraway Tree is real. I vividly remember reading that as a kid, The Faraway Tree, and Mr. the spoon guy and you know, clambering up the tree and the land of do as you please and everyone eats jam all the time and stuff like that. It was all very jolly. And my kids, even though they live in an age of Fortnite and iPads,
They took to it.
They still kind of like it, yeah. So there you go. Keeps them out of the Tom Gates books. Do your kids read Tom Gates?
No. What's that?
Is that Beast Quest or something?
No. Tom Gates, it's a kind of kid at school and the texts are written like a diary form with drawings in the margins.
It's like Diary of a Wimpy Kid, but not as it's not on the same level. Because Diary of a Wimpy Kid, I reluctantly concede, is a work of genius.
Really?
It's very, very good.
It's very good. I mean, I didn't much like it to begin with, but it's very, very good at what it does.
I think Tom Gates is good. I mean, I don't... It doesn't make me feel sad when they read it, some of these books. Roz, would you pick one?
I liked Bernardine Evaristo's choice, and she chose Under Milkwood, which I never would. I didn't actually read that much as a child. I tried to a lot, but I couldn't really...
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't take it in. I was quite anxious and hypervigilant, so I couldn't switch. You know how some people talk about going to a book as a child and it being like a refuge? Mm. I couldn't switch off enough for that to be the case. So I really wanted to read them, but I couldn't absorb them.
You become a fiction editor in a literary publication.
It's funny,
when did the switch happen?
Probably when I was doing GCSEs, and they kind of took you through a book, a chapter at a time, a lesson at a time, and I realised how great it was. But as a child, I tried to read a lot, but I found it difficult.
Oh, interesting.
So I never would have read Under Milkwood as a child, but... Bernardine has recommended it, and when I had my babies, I weirdly put it on Under Milkwood on YouTube, the Richard Burton thing, and played it to them like in the background, because, and I understand why she recommended it, because even if you don't understand it as a child, like the rhythm of it and the song of it is really nice, and it conveys some meaning even if you don't understand the meaning of the words.
Yeah.
So I liked
that. I actually thought all of these suggestions, I was a bit disappointed there weren't that many Proust in the original French, which you know, in a TLS or summer books or TLS books of the year.
Herodotus.
Yeah,
they didn't ask Freddie Raphael, so
There just seemed to be none of that. So that was good. That was good. So are we going to do our own, Thea?
Well, I wonder. Well, maybe this is part of it, but whether in other people's choices they can speak to the kind of consistency that we see in Tony Juniper's contribution, because. That one, he starts by saying that as a small child he was fascinated by nature, devouring the beautifully illustrated natural history books of the Ladybird series. So he says it was a particular privilege, therefore, when he came to become the co-author of the Ladybird Expert Guide to Climate Change, which is really nice and neat, but what little reading I did when I was a kid was absolutely nothing like what I enjoy reading now, I don't think.
Mm. I'm entirely shaped, I mean, not least because I'm named after a childhood book,
Stig of the Devil. Of course.
Which my great book. And I read it a lot. My brother, there was a poster of it in our bedroom which we shared, and that's why and it was a Neanderthal kid who didn't look entirely dissimilar to me. And that's where the name came from. But I reckon I read thrillers really early, the same way I'll bang on about genre writing. I was reading, because like you were saying, Lucy, all you did as a kid, or I did as a kid, was read whatever books were in the house.
Yeah, whatever.
And whatever they happened to be. So my parents happened, because they were obviously adults in the 70s, buy a lot of genre thriller spy fiction. So Len Dayton and John le Carré and Hammond Innes, and even earlier that Dennis Wheatley, and there's kind of that genre fiction. So basically from the age of 9, or even a bit earlier than that, I used to read those books. There's nothing else to read. And I remember it was Bring Your Book to School Day, and I had this book by a guy called Colin Forbes, who wrote really crap, really like eye-wateringly badly written books, sort of spy books. And I took it into school, and it was all about murder and rape and spying. And they're like,
Jesus.
I remember the teacher like going, okay, so let's see what books we've got. What's this one? Could you read out the back of it? And I started reading the back of it. And, she went, okay, then we'll move on.
But Stig, did everyone else have the Cat in the Hat?
Well, they didn't have Cat in the Hat, but they didn't have those books. But I was reading those kind of. So that's completely shaped me as a reader, I think. That sort of genre, plot-driven, you know.
But surely not that one in particular.
It's rubber. I can see it in my mind's eye now. I can vividly picture.
Is that what
picture.
You would choose as your book for this symposium?
No, I think it probably wouldn't be. it wouldn't. But I am conscious that I read what my parents read, and that's shaped me more than anything else.
There was a lot of talk of the Holocaust in my house. My mum's parents were both Berlin refugees, and my dad's father's family were sort of caught up in the Holocaust as well. And so my mum read a lot of adult Holocaust fiction, and I realised, looking back for this, for today, I read there were a lot of children's Holocaust novels.
Hitler Stole Mine.
Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit. I Am David by Anne Holm, I was remembering. Obviously, The Diary of Anne Frank. The Mouse book, Otto Spiegelman. And not that my adult reading is massively obsessed with Holocaust fiction or whatever, but I think I did progress to adult fiction around that sort of theme. And not just Holocaust, but kind of literature of incarceration, dystopia, that kind of thing.
Were you distressed by it as a child?
I was, yes and no. I was completely fascinated. I mean, I grew up with lots of stories of, you know, a lot of my grandparents' friends were also from that kind of milieu, and I saw people with tattoos on their arms, people who'd been to Auschwitz and survived and whatever, and it was quite a sort of common thing, and, you know, stories handed down or whatever, and so the oral history of it was very interesting to me. But it's also that, I think there's that child's enjoyment, and I use that word very cautiously, but of horror.
Yeah.
We like reading when we're kids about nasty things that happen somewhere else, and there's a kind of safety in reading about it. Although I could sort of on one level identify with it because it had been my family, it was also nothing to do with me, and it was nothing to do with my very comfortable, privileged life. And I think there was definitely a kind of combination of fear but also comfort, which sounds weird, but I think
did you let your kids read it at the same age?
Definitely. Yeah. I don't think it certainly didn't do any harm. You know, I was just thirsty for knowledge of it, and it wasn't unspoken about. It wasn't that kind of, I think for my parents' generation when they were growing up in the 50s, it was very much don't talk about this, you know, appalling thing that happened in the last few years. It was too close. But by the time I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, it was quite easily spoken about.
The horror part was what little reading I did do was very
I'm
much.
I'm amazed
kind
by
of
this that you two don't read it. I mean, I drew as a child.
I was just drawing all the time.
Really?
Yeah, and I wanted to be a cartoonist for ages and ages and ages. So I did my own cartoons.
Oh. could you do that now? Do you think? When Ella's on the weeks that Ella's off.
Whenever Ella's on holiday, I just step in and fill that.
Cartoons as in cartoon strips with words as well.
Exactly. But no, the reading was things like Alan Garner.
The Weird Stone of Brisingamen.
And The Owl Service.
More
The Owl Service, the one set in Wales in the old manor house.
I was so frightened of The Owl Service. I read it once and then afterwards I couldn't really look at it properly again.
Same.
Couldn't really look at the
cover.
Same,
I remember
it was brilliant.
Putting it on my shelf and putting another book in front of it to cover up the cover.
Really?
I still think it's pretty terrifying.
Like Joey and Friends when he puts the book in the fridge.
A bit like that, but that's Little Women, isn't it?
In the end he puts Little Women.
Oh, because it's so sad.
Yeah, you can't bear it.
Andrew from our office will be listening to this nodding happily, because he is the great Friends aficionado of the TLS.
He is, and he will remember that, that bit.
So horror books?
Horror books, yeah. I mean, the Owl Service, we had a good piece. It was the 50th anniversary of it a couple of years ago, and we had a really interesting piece, which completely, a bit like what you were saying, Toby, about Kamal Ahmed's contribution to the symposium, triggered this memory in me. I'd forgotten how obsessed I was with Alan Garner. So Dimitra Femi wrote this interesting piece about the Owl Service, and it was so much, obviously, it was so much more complicated than I understood at the time. As with all the best books, I think, you don't realise when you're a kid. You can read them on one level, and then years later you're like, oh yeah, the subtle class politics in that novel were, you know, fascinating and whatever. But yeah, that, and then there was also the Oxford Book of Nasty Endings, which was a series of...
What a great title. Yeah. Can we have that in TLS books, you think? The TLS excellent. Book of Nasty Endings. I could get behind that.
It was edited by Dennis Pepper. And it was 30 stories by, all sorts. Roald Dahl, Robert Scott, Ian Nesbitt, T.H. White, Ray Bradbury. Just all these stories with twisted, dark endings. So that thing of being, you know, really unsettled, but on your grandparents' sofa, so you're safe and fine.
I'd quite like to read that now.
It's really good. I'll lend it to you. Yeah. I've still got it. Obviously. It's not going anywhere.
I'll give that to my kids. My thing with those of us who have children, do you worry that... I think the books that we read as kids were much less focused on children. So you're often being stretched by books because you read books that exist in your family home. And books generally, I think, were written less aimed at a specific audience.
Well, think of Robert Louis Stevenson. I mean, Treasure Island exactly. is a children's book, but I think if you gave it to a child now, they'd...
I've read Treasure Island with my older son. I haven't tried it with my younger son. Mm. And... if you read a book with your kid, you can get away with it. But yeah, it's not going to work if you just give it to your.
Whereas
child.
if your kids grow up on Diary of a Wimpy Kid and Tom Gates, these books I'm talking about, I find interesting they've lost negative capability. I think children of my children's generation have no negative capability. They have no ability to be uncertain, to be unsure, to be stretching after words they don't know, because almost everything culturally is presented to them in neat packages.
I disagree a bit. So my little girl, she's only six, but she's really into the Otterline books by Chris Riddle, and they are very, age-appropriate, very clever. There's quite a bit of stretching and wonder and strangeness.
And Baroque language as well, isn't it?
Baroque language, and there's a lot of in-jokes. Hmm. That some for the kids and some for the parents and some of the kids will get later on, and I don't know.
I find lots of the stuff of that age group is, you know, when I reread Just William, which is the book I read a lot as a child, if you pick up a Just William book, the vocabulary and the sentence structure and the cultural references are very, very, very difficult. And if you read an equivalent book to that now, it seems to me of a completely different order of writing. I'm not saying one's better than the other. It just feels that notion of easy, that stretching and reaching after vocabulary isn't as common as it might be.
I know what you mean, and there is quite a lot of kind of serving up of stuff which doesn't take long to read and doesn't take that much.
But and there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with that, because it's still reading, isn't it?
I was going to say, but actually Catherine Rundell, who was the one who said she liked what Katie did, she's a brilliant children's author, and she does... her stories are quite rich. And actually, you don't always know. I remember my son reading one of them and going, but I don't know if he's the baddie or not. You know, she leaves quite a lot of uncertainty. So that's nice. And you've got to, you know, you think about it afterwards. So there's still, that stuff is still around, but maybe there's, the other stuff is easier to access, maybe.
And maybe you shouldn't think about, maybe I shouldn't think about reading in terms of stretching, because then it loses its charm. You should either just find stuff that does help you develop language, and it's got to be first of all a good book, and then it will have those effects rather than.
And I think there's always a chance that anything you press on your children, they'll resist. I certainly, the book that I thought of choosing for this, which I had at home, I was meant to bring it in, is called People in History by R.J. Unstead, who was a very, very, very popular historical writer of the kind of 50s, 60s, 70s. He was a school teacher, and I looked up about him. he wrote a review for the Times Educational Supplement of a history textbook, saying how incredibly boring and off-putting it would be for children and it made history dull. And he was sort of challenged to write a more interesting history book, and he did one called Looking at History. And then People in History, written in 1959, followed it up. And one beautiful thing about it is it starts in rather bigger print than it ends in. So it's quite a big, fat book. And you start reading about the Romans and then on to King Alfred and so on, and St. Alban and various people in sort of big, fat print and short paragraphs. And by the time you end reading about Robert Fleming and that sort of thing, it's in rather smaller print and it's a bit more grown up. So you sort of grow up with it. And to me, it was completely fascinating and wonderful stories from British history, from throughout British history. And it's sort of less blimpish than someone like Rees-Mogg, though written about 60 years ago. There are lots of women in it, for
better,
example.
Better prose, I'd imagine.
Much better prose.
We haven't talked about the prose in the Rees-Mogg book before.
Oh, that's shocking stuff. It also did occur to me that Unstead is also responsible for that thing you were talking about with Tony Juniper, for something that I had. He wrote a book, much slimmer book, in that series called Princes and Rebels. And I kind of name-checked it in a book I wrote
The English
about
Rebel.
That's the book.
Yeah. I mean, this is the fourth time that book's been mentioned in this podcast. No wonder you're willing to do this. This is basically an advertorial.
That's the idea. Well, Stig, I'm just, you know, his master's voice. I'm following a lead. Yeah. But it really did. It really did bear fruit very, very many years later. And I do think it's a tremendous writer, but I have tried to encourage both my children to
read it,
and they could not be less interested.
I did that with my grandpa. Was a print person at Lady Bird Books. And he was he worked one of the print machines in Lady Bird Books. So growing up, I had all the Lady Bird books. And I can still now, as we talk, I can imagine the kings and queens. I can see Henry V. I can see the drawings. We were talking about cheese, genuinely talking about cheese. And I was remembering the Robin Hood. There's a page in Robin Hood where he walks past a man sitting on bridge and he's eating a hunk of cheddar and a hunk of bread. And I still have to think of that all the time in my mind. And those books... And I've given them to my kids and they kind of desultory fashion look at them, but maybe they're not all that. But as for me, that was a whole world of history that you could just get relatively quickly, relatively easily.
And I do think that although I like things like Horrible Histories, I wonder if that's giving you the kind of alternative version before you know the traditional version. So it's an alternative to something you don't already understand, which I'm not sure if the joke works quite so well,
because they're not it's not the history with the boring bits left out, because they've never had the boring bits.
Exactly, all histories like that, and so you don't really have much of an idea of history itself.
It is good Horrible Histories, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm very much in favour of it in general.
Yeah, my son once asked me about Owen Glendower, and I remember being, where the hell did that come from? I wasn't just asking about Henry VIII. You know, who would you think of Owen Glendower? It's because of something in
Welsh rebel, of course.
It seems to me, actually, you could have written a book. You could have known. No, he didn't write a book about Welsh rebels, although you should have done it, would appear. You haven't.
You still can.
Yeah, you visit Wales all the time.
Everybody knows that the Scots, Irish and Welsh were rebels. The idea was that people don't think of England as having
good
idea.
History. Yeah, but that book sells itself in some ways, doesn't
brilliant
it?
Brilliant idea.
Well, if by that you mean doesn't sell very much, yes.
Lucy and Roz, weren't we going to have books that shaped your childhood?
I don't know if it shaped me. I mean, it didn't. I don't think it shaped my career. I mean, you'll see why. But the one that sticks in my mind that I read again and again and again and again, that I can still remember lots of, is The Once and Future King by T.H. White.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't really know why. It took me a while get to reading it.
In terms of...
What do you mean, there's time?
For you to achieve
don't
that destiny.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I see. No, I was going to say, because I'm not yet the king.
No, yeah, exactly. That's what David's point. The monarchy's a great land of
but
opportunity.
I wouldn't mind, because I read about it a lot, so I feel I would have
some
of the qualifications. Yeah. And it took me a while to get into it. It's quite difficult for younger kids, because there's a bit at the beginning that's quite horrible. He's very good at doing kind of village life, and it's quite brutal. Do you want to know the brutal bit?
Yeah, of course.
So there's a.
So there's I told a you guy, my reading.
Exactly.
There's a guy called Watt, W-A-T, without a nose, and the kids throw stones at him. And one day, he grabs one of the kids and bites his nose off. And first of all, this was read to us, and I would have to say stop at that bit. I couldn't get past that bit when I was quite little.
Like a Victorian heroine.
A bit like that. But then later on, I read it for myself, and it's okay, everyone, because then what makes friends with a boy goes off and they both look after the dogs.
Is that Kay?
In... No, it's not Kay. I mean, what goes off?
But with the boy he bit the nose off?
Yeah, because
very forgiving
they're
boy.
Reconciled. I mean, he is very forgiving. It is very forgiving. But they both find happiness with the dogs in the court of Sir Ector, who is the, what do you call it, sort of adoptive father of the wart.
Yes.
Who is, in fact, King
and this
Arthur.
And this is the Sword and the Stone. This is the book that...
It's the whole thing. It's part of it, yeah.
Which became the film, the Disney film.
Yeah, so it starts with Arthur very young and very put upon. Because he's the poor relation.
Is that Wart?
That's the Wart.
Yeah.
And you don't know that's King Arthur. He's just a little boy and he's running about and he has to do errands and he's, you know, he's very much the underdog.
Yeah.
And then at some point he meets Merlin and Merlin teaches him about the world by being an animal. So the first book, you know, for a kid, like he flies and he's an ant and he's a goose and it's just magic.
But so what happens to the guy with no nose?
He stays with the dogs and they're happy. It's fine.
Let it go. Yeah. He's fine.
No, the dogs are fine.
The dogs are quite important, actually. The whole animal world is quite important. But then it tells the saga of the whole thing.
So the guy who's been mutated has to live with the dogs?
No, he likes living with the dogs.
All right.
Like, that's his job.
Why does he have no nose?
The first guy, I don't know.
No. How does he smell? Well done, yeah. I've been thinking about that for about a minute. I thought I wasn't going
to
say that.
Serious book and quite important to me.
Hang on a second. Did he have his nose cut off kind of judicially?
No, I don't think so. He just was, you know, he was born that way, like Lady Gaga. I mean, I know she's got a nose, but you know what I mean. Anyway, look, the thing is, you start off with it's a bit like...
Does Lady Gaga not have a nose?
No, she says born that way.
That's her.
Come on, guys, get with it.
Your cultural references are
look,
far above.
Yeah, there's a pop cultural ref. Should we go on a treasure hunt?
The point about the book, though, is that it moves from the childhood through his young adulthood when he becomes the king and then to late in life, and it gets very complicated and very sad. And it sort of takes you the whole way. And I just sort of thought, and still think in a way, that the whole of life is in there. It's got everything.
Oh.
And I think it's probably
except
quite
Moses.
A weird book. I remember my parents kind of saying, "This is a very odd man." I think he probably was a very odd man.
Sounds
don't know
like
much
it.
About him. No, but I mean, really quite odd, I think.
Roz, we need yours.
Yes, sorry.
So one of the few books I do remember being completely engrossed by was Danny Champion of the World.
Yeah.
And I started reading it again the last few days and it's amazing and completely different when you're an adult. So when you're a child, you just have this story of Danny, whose mother died when he was 4 months old. Danny lives in a gypsy caravan with his dad. Danny's basically completely in love with his father. He says, "I love the way he moves. When he smiles with his eyes, and he's a car mechanic and he teaches Danny how to drive cars and fix cars." But Danny's dad is also a poacher.
Oh.
And Danny ends up going to sort of save his father. And, it's just amazing. Roald Dahl is incredible. He has so much respect for children's feelings and emotions.
Yeah.
And he still lets you encounter, like, the difficult stuff, but with such reverence for how children think and behave.
And see as well. He talked about how you have to have a child's eye view of the world, and that for him involved, he's a very tall man, involved getting down on his hands and knees and looking at the world around him from that vantage point. And it really comes through in his fiction as well, I think.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Amazing.
And then when you look at this book from an adult's perspective, you're like, oh, Danny's completely in love with his father. And Roald Dahl captures that feeling so much of like being in love with your parents. Danny's so in love with his father, and his father's not looking after him that well.
And his father's often poaching.
His father's often poaching.
To put food on the table, really.
No, he does it because it's an art.
He's a car mechanic.
Yeah. They don't really eat them, do they? No. Not much.
Because he doesn't like the landowner as well.
He doesn't like the landowner.
Stick it up to the landowner. What's his name?
Is he an English rebel?
I couldn't
possibly
say.
They all are. Everyone in the village are. The doctor used to poach. Like, everyone is. And they're all against the landowner.
Do you know what? I've really enjoyed this. It's been lovely. It's been such nice choices. Apart from David shamelessly plugging his book,
I believe it's R.J. Anstead.
It's been lovely. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to the TLS team of David Rees-Mogg, Horsepool, Toby Lishtig, Lucy Dallas and Roz Dineen. Use those codes I mentioned to subscribe to the TLS and never miss an issue. Next week, we remember 300 years of Robinson Crusoe, among a host of other things. Come back next week for more. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.